Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Washington slept here. Those words grate on the nerves of Nathaniel Philbrick. The reason they do is answered in Mr. Philbrick's new book, A Blend of History and Travelogue. It's called Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. In 2018 and 2019, the author, his wife, and their dog embarked on several trips tracing the path followed by George Washington during the first years of his presidency. Washington went on four trips between 1789 and 1791. And on each, the new president of the new nation known as the United States hoped to transform what had been 13 colonies into the unified country promised by the newly ratified Constitution. The longest of those trips, by far, was the president's tour of the South. In the spring and early summer of 1791, Washington and his small entourage traveled 1,800 miles from the temporary capital in Philadelphia through Delaware and Maryland and south as far as Savannah. From there, Washington schlepped and slept in towns and cities in Georgia, the Carolinas, and back north. Apologies to Chris Buckley for stealing his schlep line. But let me not tell too much of the story. We have the author here to do just that. Nathaniel Philbrick, greetings from North Carolina, one of the two states that held out before finally ratifying the Constitution.
Great to be with you. And yes, yeah, you are one of the prodigal states.
That's right. That's right. Before we get to what's in your book, on behalf of the city of Charlotte, allow me to offer thanks for what is not in Travels with George. And that is his diary entry from May 28th, 1791, when the president wrote that Charlotte, quote, is a very trifling place, end quote.
Yeah, he was not too impressed by it, I hate to say, but I didn't feel the need to beat up on Charlotte, a city my wife Melissa and I and our dog Dora really, really came to love.
Well, I want to go back to where this started for you at the historical Rhode Island home of John Brown, not the John Brown who was involved in the insurrection that led into the Civil War, but the John Brown who helped found Brown University. This was during a research trip you took to Providence. What did you see there and what did it inspire?
Yeah, well, in the back of Brown's magisterial brick house is his chariot. It's a tiny little carriage. The seat is about the size of the rear seat of a VW with four big wheels. And it's John Brown's chariot that was built at great expense. This was the high technology transportation of its day. And according to Brown family tradition, John Brown took the newly inaugurated president, George Washington, on a ride through Providence to his boatyard where he could see the ship he was building that was actually named for George Washington. And I saw this and I said, wow, this is a tiny little thing. I can't imagine two people in it, let alone one as large as George Washington. But what was the president doing in Providence? And he had just become president. What was going on? And that's when I began to learn more about the fact that when Washington became president, he realized he was a leader of 13 essentially independent states. He had to do something to unite this country. This is before mass media, you know, before you can get on the TV and talk to people. He figured he had to go to all these towns and villages and cities throughout the country. So he went on a series of road trips that took him to all 13 states, going as far north as Kittery Point, Maine, and as far south, as you said, Savannah, Georgia. And so I decided that I was sick of being in my office working on these, you know, dense works of history. I needed to get out and see the country I'd been writing about. My wife had just retired. We had a new puppy. John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie is one of my favorite books. We're going to do our Steinbeck imitation and follow George Washington's travels through the country.
Two key points there. One is the puppy is a duck tolling retriever, correct?
That's right. A Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever.
Okay, so that helped you make friends along the way, as you detail in the book. And the other thing that you just mentioned that I wanted you to maybe elaborate just a little on is you mentioned George Washington was a very large man for his time. How large was he?
he was 6 foot, 6 foot, 4 inches tall, somewhere in between there. And this was a giant back then. There's one account of him visiting Hampton Plantation in South Carolina. And there's a letter from one of the people who saw him and said, "My God, the man is a giant. He had the largest hands I have ever seen in a human being." I mean, he was a big guy. And so you get him, what he would do before he arrived in a town, he would get out of his horse-drawn carriage, get on his great big white horse, and ride into town. And the sight of George Washington dressed in his general's uniform on a horse was apparently quite stunning. And so he was not above a little theatrics.
And it's quite interesting to learn how and why he set up his tour of the new United States. What was Washington's thinking with the purpose and routing of these four trips?
Yeah, well, I think those of us today don't really realize how divided the country was even at its very beginning. The Constitution had divided the country because a good portion of the country believed that a stronger federal government was needed. These were known as Federalists. There are no organized parties as of yet, but others, many of them Southerners, particularly in North Carolina, distrusted the creation of a strong federal government, really felt the state should keep the power they had had in the previous form of government under the Articles of Confederation. And so when Washington was elected, North Carolina and Rhode Island had not yet ratified the Constitution. He really needed to go out there and try to reach across the political divide. And the other thing that was going on was their regional differences. When the governor of Virginia said, "My country," he meant Virginia. He did not mean United States of America. So, you know, he was a new thing, a president, an elected president of a republic. You know, this didn't exist anywhere else in the world. So he felt he needed to visit all these towns and show people that there's now something beyond your town, your state. There's something called the United States of America.
That's the voice of Nathaniel Philbrick. He is the author of the new book, Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. As your discovery of the horse-drawn carriage showed you, the new president did not exactly travel Air Force One style. And as you write, his accommodations were often equally Spartan. So what did you learn about how he traveled and what the environment was like around him?
Yeah, well, he made a decision at the very beginning that he was not going to play favorites. He was not going to stay in the homes of the rich friends that wanted him to stay with him. He was going to stay only in public taverns. Now, today we think of a historic tavern as perhaps a nice B&B where we get waffles in the morning, something like that. This was not the case in the late 18th century. This was very basic accommodations. This was more like a Motel 6, you know, a roadside accommodation where the beds were bad, the food was even worse. And, you know, as you said earlier in his review of North Carolina, it's a good thing there was no such thing as TripAdvisor in 1789, because, you know, he was doing this for political reasons. It didn't mean he had to enjoy it. I mean, there was at one point, actually two times in his New England tour where he'd, you know, come to an inn at night and someone in the entourage would tap on the door. And they didn't recognize Washington. They said, go away. We don't have room for you. And, you know, this was, as you said, not Air Force One. This was someone going out there trying to, yes, I am the President of the United States, but I am one of you, you know, a person just like you. I am a citizen of the United States, and I'm staying in public taverns.
And on that note, you write that prior to his Southern travels, Washington consulted with several congressmen from this part of the country, as well as a Supreme Court justice named James Iredell. And referring to the anticipated spring rains in this part of the country and the Piedmont clay, Iredell told Washington, quote, "The accommodations are very wretched and the country a very miserable one," end quote. And you just explained, you know, that he obviously wanted to unify the country. Why was it so important to him that he be seen as a man of the people? Because you just mentioned at other times he would go with the theatrics of being a standout personality. So how did he balance those two wishes?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very good point. He was balancing, you know, he wanted to wow people. He wanted to create a sense of pride in the nation. But he also didn't want, there were already people, particularly in places like North Carolina, that were issuing the alarm, Washington is just going to become another monarch. He's going to become our version of King George. And we just went through a rebellion. We do not want that. And so Washington's treading a very fine line between, yes, I am the guy who won the revolution. You know, I am a renowned military leader, perhaps the most famous person in the world at this point, but I am also one of you. I am a citizen of the United States. I am staying in these wretched taverns. I'm traveling over these wretched roads so that you'll see me, you know. And so sometimes he would wear his general's uniform to wow the people. Other times when he felt it was necessary, he would wear his very subdued brown suit that had been made in America, in Connecticut. And so, you know, he would play it as best he could because he was playing politics, even as he was trying to, you know, he was on a road trip and trying to see the country.
And I don't know if you noticed this when you were driving through this part of the country, but I should mention that obviously I'm speaking to you from Charlotte, which is the largest part of Mecklenburg County. And that is directly adjacent to and south of Iredell County. And until I read your book, I had no idea where Iredell County got its name. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, that, you know, that speaks to what the kind of revelation we were discovering over and over again. Tip O'Neill, the Massachusetts politician, used to say that all politics is local. Well, I am here before you today to say all history is local. And where we find out something like that Iredell comment, you just find the stuff that escaped the national gaze on Washington, but is preserved in the archives of each town. And before we even left, I decided I wanted to reach out to all the town libraries and historical societies as I could, because I wanted to know how Washington had been remembered. You know, beyond the historical plaque, beyond the claim he had slept here, I wanted to know, you know, how did people respond? What memories were there? And in doing that, it was one of those, it was almost like archaeology. We'd get these accounts of a woman in Long Island when she was 6 years old at the gate of her house, watching Washington walk, ride by, and across the street, they were building a one-room schoolhouse, and Washington gets down off his horse and helps them raise the rafter onto the roof. You know, this is the kind of thing that you're not going to find out unless you go there, look around, and sure enough, there was an historical plaque talking about the fact that there had been a one-room schoolhouse there. So, you know, these little vortexes of history were everywhere.
And I want to go down one little side path before we take our first break, which is that another thing that you mentioned in regard to Supreme Court Justice Iredell is that part of the reason that he was so familiar with where Washington would be traveling was not just because he was a North Carolinian, but because at the time, Supreme Court justices worked the circuit, which I honestly had no idea of. I mean, that's just a fascinating way to think of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah. You know, today, if you're a member of the Supreme Court, you've made it. There were plenty of people who said, I don't want to be in the Supreme Court because I don't want to have to spend my time riding from little town to little town over terrible roads. And so you're right. It was nothing like it is today, you know, where you're kind of like Oz behind the curtain. Back then, like Washington, you had to get on your horse or carriage and go from town to town. The scale of the country was entirely different. It was an intimate world where, you know, it was face to face. It wasn't, you know, social media, TV. You had to actually go there and talk to people. What a unique thought.
What a notion. Well, we need to get on our horse and take our first break. More with Nathaniel Philbrick and George Washington when we return. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is historian Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George, and it traces President Washington's travels across the United States between 1789 and 1791. In the book, your narrative shifts between Washington's journeys and, as you mentioned earlier, your own contemporary experiences with your wife and your new puppy. Confederate monuments and the still painful legacies of slavery and racism appropriately play large roles in your thinking and observations. What do you think of Washington's views and actions on race?
Right. Well, you know, one of the things I want people to get from this book is how far Washington traveled, not just across the country, but in terms of his views of race. I mean, this was someone who at the age of 11 became a slaveholder when his father died and he inherited some enslaved people. And then he became general of the Continental Army, and the 8 years of war changed him. He emerged from that experience, realizing that slavery was a pernicious institution. And one of his closest friends and confidants during the war was the young idealistic Frenchman Lafayette, who would later say, "If I knew I was helping to create a land of slavery, I never would have lifted my sword in the cause of the American Revolution." And Washington heard this. But, you know, there were 300 enslaved people at Mount Vernon. He owned about half of them. The other half were part of the estate of Martha's dead husband. And so Washington could not free them. And he wanted to free his enslaved people, but to do so would create rifts in families because the two groups had intermarried. And so, you know, he was tortured with what to do about this. Upon his death, his will insisted that his enslaved workers would be free. He would be the only slaveholding founding father to do that. But, you know, he didn't do it until the end. And even as he's planning on freeing his enslaved workers, he's pursuing one of Martha's enslaved house servants who had
escaped, Judge, right?
And who had escaped from Philadelphia seeking freedom in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And Washington felt that since he was the legal guardian of her two grandchildren, it was up to him to reclaim what was owed to the estate. But this also blinded him to, you know, the injustice of pursuing a young woman who's just trying to be free. And so, you know, that's the tough thing with Washington's legacy. He's much like this country. He aspires to an ideal that all of us are created equal, but he doesn't succeed in getting beyond the preconceptions of his own society. He's a flawed human being like all of us. And so I wanted with this book for people to realize that, you know, yes, Washington was absolutely critical to the founding of this nation, but he was also hopelessly involved with the institution of slavery. And any evaluation of his role in the creation and formation of this country has to take a long look at his relationship with slavery.
You know, you talk in the book, and so many of us think about Washington and Jefferson and these other founders, and we go back and forth about trying to view them in the context of their time and what they did right and what they did wrong. But I'm wondering, how do you see when it comes to race and how they dealt with the enslaved people that they owned? How would you compare Jefferson and Washington in particular?
Yeah, well, you know, Jefferson would never free his enslaved workers. We now know children through one of his enslaved workers. And in his book, Notes on Virginia, he comments on how he feels that African-Americans are intellectually inferior to white people. But he also is the author of the Declaration of Independence, in which is declared that we all men are created equal. It's interesting. One of the African-American surveyors that Washington hired to survey Washington, D.C., a guy who would write, he was a genius, a self-taught genius who was, you know, astronomer, was a surveyor, built a clock out of wood, published his own almanac. When he was working on surveying Washington, D.C. that summer, he wrote Thomas Jefferson a letter and said to Thomas Jefferson, "You know, my thanks for your writing the Declaration of Independence, but how can you, in good conscience, keep enslaved people in your own household, given this, and he brings him to task. And so, you know, that is where and Jefferson was also for states, much more for states' rights. He would take the Anti-Federalist Party and turn it into the Republican Party, not the party we have today. And, you know, he was actually trying to undermine Washington's efforts to create a strong, united country by doing this, even when he was Washington's Secretary of State. In terms of Washington, what he believed with all his heart and with all his failures and his flaws was in the Union. This was the concept that for him that required, and he recognized that for the Union to endure, slavery would have to end. I mean, he's quoted as saying that. And, you know, it would be the Union that would lead Abraham Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, you know, Washington, you know, I think Washington was much more of a straight shooter than Jefferson. Washington was well aware of his inconsistencies and flaws, and they truly agonized him. And, you know, ultimately, it's up to every individual to make the assessment of how they look at the past. But, you know, the worst thing you can do is to take our current standards and insist that the people from the past live by those. I mean, none of us live up to where we are now. You know, when we 20 years ago.
Yes.
And if you add a couple hundred years to that, you know, it's just a completely different time. And yet it's important. The people that latch onto concepts that we are still looking to today as forces of unity and equality, that's important. And I think Washington is one of those people.
You know, it strikes me that Jefferson, and I think probably Hamilton as well, if Bob Woodward was alive then, they would be two of the guys that are leaking furiously to Bob Woodward for his couple of books during the administration.
Absolutely. They were in Washington's cabinet. They hated each other, Jefferson and Hamilton. Hamilton was a Federalist, was for a strong federal government. He was instituting the economic policy, such as the tax on whiskey that was not popular in the South and Western Pennsylvania, but was convinced that Jefferson was undermining the legitimacy of Washington's government, which Jefferson was secretly. And, you know, and Jefferson felt that Hamilton was goading Washington into creating a virtual corrupt monarchy, you know, based on the almighty Northern dollar, you know, rather than, you know, the agrarian South, which he saw as kind of the model of a good citizen, even though he did not like to consider slavery in that equation. And so, yes, those two would have been leaking it to the press. And in fact, Jefferson would hire someone in the state to supposedly work for him in the State Department as a translator, whose job really was to form a newspaper that was critical to Washington's administration. And so, you know, we have a political divide now. There's partisanship rampant. If Washington magically returned today, I don't think you'd be surprised by what we're in the middle of, because it happened to him in his second term. But luckily, he had hit the road in his first term and created a sense of unity and of a federal government that was built to last, at least up until now, until, you know, who knows where we'll take it.
That's the voice of Nathaniel Philbrick. He is the author of Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. I want to ask you, some of your travels with George through the Carolinas included Charleston, where Washington was feted in raucous fashion with constant dinners and parties. And you write that, quote, his charisma was his superpower and he enjoyed showing it off, end quote. What made Washington so good at the important superficialities of political life?
Right. Well, his personality had been, he had spent his life sort of creating a persona. And I mean, from when he was a kid, he had an anger management problem and he began to realize, ooh, this is a potentially fatal flaw. He worked to control that. He created, you know, the marble man that we all, you know, hear about. That was generated so that, you know, he could be that person who walks into a room and the charisma just radiates off him. But he wasn't prone to small talk. You know, inappropriate jokes, the gaffes that can so often plague a leader. And he said as little as possible.
He stayed on message in modern parlance.
Exactly. And he understood the power of silence. He also understood the power of just a few words at the right moment could just completely change things. And so he had a sense of the theatrics, but he also knew to just let that superpower, I call it the Washington effect. When he would come to a place, even particularly in the Southern tour, when he's there in inland North Carolina, in Charlotte, a lot of people are upset about the tax policies that Washington's government, led by Hamilton, are promulgating. And Washington would make a point of explaining why, well, you may not like it completely. How else are we going to raise the money to run this country? And he was under the impression that pretty much everyone he talked to, once they got the point of view he was trying to convey, understood it. The remarkable thing is there would be the whiskey insurrection in Western Pennsylvania, one of the few places Washington did not go to during his tour, but there would be flares of violence in the South, but nothing like that. And I think you can attribute that to the fact that Washington went out there, talked to people, and let the power of the Washington effect have its influence.
For the way you describe his travels and his behavior, he also seemed to have incredible stamina to withstand, which, let's face it, this can be mind-numbing in a modern political campaign or 200-300 years ago, to have to, even if you're not making the small talk, you have to listen to the small talk and you have to go to the party and the reception and hear the band play each and every day over and over and over. Where did that come from? Was that a lifelong trait?
Yeah, well, he enjoyed a little bit some of pomp and circumstance, but he had a short fuse when it was not fun anymore. For example, he hated it when the local militia on their horses would lead him, into a town because it kicked up dust that, choking clouds of dust that made life in his carriage miserable. And so he would often say he was leaving at 10 a.m. and actually leave at 8. And so he could leave without an escort. So he developed tricks to sort of, but he had that ability to sit through, how many rubber chicken dinners, he endured with endless toasts. But, these things were, this was before tweets, and those toasts were the 18th century version of that. So it was ceremonial. It might be boring to, from our senses, but there was a complex theatrical ritual going on, and Washington understood, the power of that, and so he was willing to participate. The other side of it is his health really began to decline almost as soon as he became president.
He was 57, right?
Yeah, he was 57. The pressures of the office, but he was also not getting exercise. And he was a guy who, ever since he was a teenager, was traveling, whether it was as a surveyor, whether it was as a general or a plantation owner. He would ride his horse 6 hours a day inspecting Mount Vernon. But when he became president, that stopped. One of the reasons he decided, embraced going on these tours and enduring all of these dinners and things like that, was it got him out of the office. It got him on his horse, his big white horse, Prescott. And he loved travel. And so, and it was good for his health. Every time he comes back from one of these tours, he comments on how he's feeling much better. And so, there was a side to this that was actually good for him. But that also meant he had to endure what I think most people would just, run screaming from, I don't want to listen to another one of these interminable addresses.
Now, as I mentioned, obviously, we are here in North Carolina. In this state, the highest honor from the governor is the Order of the Longleaf Pine. And one of the things that I found really interesting about your book is you talk about trees, you talk about the longleaf pine in particular. And you describe longleaf pines, they're not the pine trees that we think of today.
Right.
And so I want you to expand a little bit on that, but then also why it's important for us to understand the natural world as we're understanding Washington in this context.
Right. Well, that was one of the most fascinating aspects of this, of the Southern tour for Melissa and I, was to learn about the longleaf pine. Because, you know, I went to Duke for a year, and Melissa was also in Durham. And so, you know, we were very familiar with pine forests and all that, but those are loblolly. The longleaf pine was a species of pine that dominated the South. All the way west to Texas. I mean, it was one unending primeval forest of these longleaf pines that were very straight trees with their branches up high. Apparently when you were in, and they would live for decades, hundreds of years, they were very resistant to fire. In fact, they wanted fire because they needed fire because it burned the undergrowth. And so you had these magnificent forests of huge trees where, you know, you could, there was often grass underneath them, and you could, but it was, there was an unending sameness about it. You know, you could really lose your way in it. When there was wind, you'd hear the branches overhead, creating this unearthly sound. It was just a whole different landscape from what we're used today. And so Washington describes it as, you know, it's, for him, it was kind of forbidding and desolate because there was just this unending similarity to where it was. And, but what would happen is, of course, tar heels, these would be chopped down to create tar and pitch for the naval, for naval goods. And there would also be fire prevention as more and more people came. And as that happened, it made, they were chopping down the trees, the fires that made it possible for these pines to prosper were no more, and now there are none of them except for places where they are being consciously regrown. And we went to one place such as that in very southern North Carolina on the eastern side, and they are young pines, but it's just totally different from the pine forest all of us know now.
Let's leave it there, and we will pick up the story. When we come back, we've got Nathaniel Philbrick here with us talking about Travels with George. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is historian Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George, and it traces President Washington's journeys across the United States between 1789 and 1791. You were talking about the ecological discoveries you and your wife made on your journeys. But for us, reading in the modern day, why is it important to understand the landscape that Washington encountered?
Yeah, because it's changed completely from what it is today. And I think, you know, the fragility of the landscape, you know, it was, I think, unimaginable for people back in the late 18th century to think that these pines would at some point just vanish from the face of the earth. But that would happen. And this applies to us today as we're dealing with climate change and all of this as our whole climate seems to be changing all the while. Washington was dealing with a changing world just as we are today. This was for us, it was a way to it was kind of sobering to think here we are following Washington. Every now and then we get into a pine forest and that along one of the roads he actually went down, particularly in South Carolina, where they had been the main road, but other highways had taken the traffic away, and yet the old road was still there. And so, you know, we'd go down the same road Washington went. We were surrounded by pine trees, but they were different, you know, and yet, you could still squint and sort of say, hey, I'm in my carriage, even though I'm in a Honda Pilot, and I'm there with Washington.
I'm bouncing around a little bit your travels here through the South. I was surprised to learn from your book that the architect of the White House, James Hoban, an Irishman, was hired by Washington after Washington visited Columbia, obviously 90 minutes down the road from us, and admired the Capitol building that he had designed. I should mention that this is not the same Capitol building that you saw on your trip or that we see regularly here. But what did he like about the previous Capitol that made him want to hire this architect for the White House?
Yeah, well, it looked a lot like what would become the White House, and they were, whether it was Washington or Jefferson, they were all very much for Georgian classical architecture, the symmetry, the Greek influence. And so it was this white temple in the middle of a longleaf pine forest in Columbia, South Carolina, and it caught his eye. And he had already hired an architect when it came to building what would become Washington, D.C., but they would have a falling out. And so Washington remembered this building. He actually met the architect, who was a young Scotsman in Charleston, and he would become, be very close with Washington as Washington labored to try to finish the White House so that a president could actually move in. I mean, this was one of the great obsessions of his final term as president. It would take a while, but finally John Adams would move in, the second president of the United States, into the White House that wasn't really finished. But, this just shows you, Washington's going on this tour, but he's observing, he's seeing things that he remembers. And, it was a two-way street. He was making impressions on people, but people were making impressions upon him.
And I should mention for context, so when Washington is elected president, New York is the capital. Then, as you just outlined, Washington very much wants this federal city. The compromise is to put the capital temporarily in Philadelphia, which is where Washington was living. And then he's trying to negotiate the land deals. As you mentioned, he was a surveyor earlier in his life. He's trying to figure out these land deals and what it's going to look like as he's traveling all over the country. And oh, by the way, he's not texting with his aides back in Philadelphia. I'm curious, what was it like for him in terms of being so distant, disconnected from things that he might need to tend to?
Right. I mean, it's inconceivable to us today that a president would go off the grid for 3 months. I mean, obviously no internet. He had left instructions with his cabinet. If something should come up during my Southern tour that you need me back, I'll drop everything, send me a message. And these are where the places I'm planning to be. Send me a message and I'll be back in a month. this was instant communication back then, but it's like all technology. That was state of the art for them. They did not see themselves as suffering under any great technological handicap. This is the way it was. And, the whole pace of life was different. He was going 40 miles a day, and having to stop several times during the day to feed both the horses and the people. And then meet all of these people. It was just a pace of life that is very different. And yet it was hectic in its own way. As Melissa and I could testify, yes, he was only going 40 miles a day, but there were people along the way, just about everywhere he went. He's stopping at all these villages. And so it wasn't as if, I think we have a tendency to think back, oh, it was such a simpler time. When people could just sort of, they knew where they were going and, all of that. No, it was, the pace was different in certain ways, but it was just as intense and just as bewildering and scary as it is today. And Washington was in the middle of it.
I want to ask you a couple of painting questions. One is, you mentioned earlier Prescott, who was the horse that was on the journey, and Washington would exercise riding Prescott, but then he would also get out of the carriage just before approaching a town or a city and ride in dramatically, as you mentioned. But you also describe how Prescott was literally painted to make the best impression. What was that about?
Well, yes, there was a when he visited Charleston, South Carolina, the citizens requested that there be a painting of Washington visiting the city. And initially, the artist Trumbull made didn't quite get the memo and did a painting of Washington winning one of the Revolutionary War battles. And a congressman from South Carolina said, you know, this is a great painting, but it's really not what we had in mind. We wanted a painting of him visiting our city where he made this great impression. So Trumbull went back to the drawing board, so to speak, and did this magnificent painting that is now on display in a city building in Charleston of Washington in front of Prescott with the view of Charleston on the other side of the river before them. And it's a magnificent painting, except the fact that Prescott's his rear end is in the foreground. And on top of that, his tail is up as if he's relieving himself on the city of Charleston. Now, this has become a great source of historical amusement among historical tour guides in Charleston, where they talk about this horse's butt and how the painter once he got the memo he needed to do something different, said, okay, well, pay me first and I'll do the painting, and did this message to the citizens of Charleston. I think I think that's really not true. Back then, a horse's hiney was not something that sort of more like the fender of a car, it was not
exactly like that.
Right. It was what you got around. Because I've seen plenty of other portraits of Washington in which the rear end of Prescott is prominently displayed, and there's none of this. I think it's more of a 20th and 21st century sensibility looking at this. I don't think if you were in the 18th century, you took real offense. It's a magnificent painting in any event. And if the tour guides in Charleston can keep people amused by it, I'm all for it.
Again, that's the voice of Nathaniel Philbrick. He is the author of Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. Let's stick with the arts for a moment. One of the happy surprises of this book for me is that you visited the Trail of History on the Little Sugar Creek Greenway here in Charlotte. And you spoke with Chaz Fagan, who's a local sculptor. He made statues of the Catawba leader King Hagler and Thomas Spratt, who's a colonialist. What struck you about their story?
Yeah, well,
Chaz's story.
Yeah, well, we had visited the Catawba reservation in South Carolina, and they had actually directed us to the statue, knowing that Chaz Fagan had done a lot of research into it, into the Catawba tribe, as well as Washington's relationship with Native Americans. And so we sought it out. And, and this is a time where public sculpture is creates a lot of potential controversy, to the point is, what do you memorialize and without angering somebody? And this seemed... these two figures, both of whom are equals as they, look out at you, really struck both Melissa and I as just a wonderful celebration of two cultures working together. Not that the story of the Catawba would the Catawba people would experience all sorts of injustices at the hands of their white neighbors, but this sculpture seemed to us a really evocative monument that brought and for me it was like I want to know more about these characters. It inspired me to learn more about the past and ultimately to reach out to Chaz Fagan to talk about the process by which he had done this. And so, it was, I was interviewed by Brian Lamb of C-SPAN and he, about the book, and he was remembering, Chaz Fagan, because Chaz got his start, doing a bust of Lafayette for C-SPAN. And
I did not know that.
Was, you know, which Brian remembers very fondly and takes, you know, full credit for the career that he had since. But I mean, so this has just been, you know, it was at a time when Confederate statues were being removed, where, you know, it was just so hard to this seemed an instance to us where, you know, this was the kind of public sculpture that was both thoughtful and even-handed, and, you know, spoke to a past that we should all be aware of.
Now, you started as a journalist, God help you, and you wrote about sailing. You're a lifelong sailing enthusiast, and eventually that led you to history and your breakthrough book, which many people probably know, told the true story of the whaling ship that inspired Moby Dick. And you've now spent a number of years exploring the Revolutionary era and, of course, George Washington, whom we're discussing today. Any idea where you want to go next?
Yeah, well, you know, this has been more than 10 year with the revolution in Washington, and it's been great. But it's time for me to move on. I'm working my way across this country, geographically, not necessarily chronologically. And one of the books I wrote before I got into the revolution was called The Last Stand, about the Battle of Little Bighorn. I spent 4 years in Montana and nearby states researching. It was just, for me, it was just fascinating. I've missed the West ever since. And now that the Revolutionary series enabled me to work up and down the coast, I'm looking west again. The California Gold Rush is my next topic. And I'm really looking forward to it. I live on Nantucket Island off Massachusetts. Nantucketers, when they heard about the discovery of gold, loaded their whale ships full of potential prospectors, sail around the Horn, and literally abandoned those ships at the Golden Gate. And then people went, of course, 49ers went overland. And so I'm really looking forward to, you know, looking into what the creation of California and the collision of all the cultures, native peoples, white Anglo-Americans, Asian, Hispanic. So I'm headed west.
Wow, that sounds good. So last question is, we're speaking obviously in the month of October, and I read an old interview with you in which you mentioned that one of your favorite writers and major influences is Stephen King, which people may not glean from your subject matter. But given that Halloween is upon us, what are a couple of Stephen King novels you would recommend for someone who's in the mood to be frightened?
Yeah. Well, Pet Sematary is just one of those. We used to own a house in Maine where the logging trucks would go by. And it was basically, we were living on Stephen King Street, metaphorically, if not literally. And that, you know, and we own dogs and we've owned cats. And that for me, that's one of the great. The Shining is great. But I, you know, I'm also into the Dark Tower series. That just completely wowed me. That first book about, you know, sort of a Clint Eastwood movie meets a horror film, and, you know, it's just great. So, he's one of the great ones. And, you know, in my books, I like to delve into the darkness as much as possible. And, I think, my early love of Stephen King, sort of has led me in that.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, Nathaniel Philbrick. Thank you so much for joining us on Charlotte Talks.
Oh, it's been great to talk to you.
Again, that's Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is called Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us on Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.